This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. So glad you could be with us this afternoon. The information age has hit puberty and is experiencing growing pains. That observation comes from writer and entrepreneur Matt Mason. He thinks youth and youth culture will carry us through those growing pains. Matt Mason is the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism, and he is our guest this afternoon. Mason says we're surrounded by pirates, and they are changing the way we use information and the nature of our economic system. You'll find Matt Mason online at thepiratesdilemma.com. There you can download his book, and in keeping with the ideas spelled out in The Pirate's Dilemma, you name the price. You may download it for free. Mason, who says piracy is not a threat for authors but an opportunity, views the electronic version of the book differently than the one I hold in my hands this afternoon. Listeners, I look forward to your telephone calls in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I look forward to your questions and comments. A physical version of Matt Mason's book is available in paperback from the Free Press. Suggested retail, $15. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, why give away your book online?
Well, we looked at the physical book and the electronic copy of the book as two very, very different objects. One is a physical thing that you can keep, and one is, and it's very difficult to copy a physical book or even print one out. And the electronic version is something entirely different. And the reason we did this was that very soon after the hardback version of the book was published in 2008, it was pirated. A PDF started to appear on the Pirate Bay and on the torrent site. And so my publishers just thought, well, let's, in keeping with the message of the book, let's try and gain control of the piracy. Let's try and at least channel people who want the electronic version to our website. And if they do want to leave some money, then great. And it was amazing because this became a found money. This was an entirely different revenue stream. The electronic free copy of the book did not cannibalize sales of the hard copy of the book, and actually something, I think it was around a quarter of people last time I did the math, actually ended up paying $5 or more for the electronic copy of the book, and that was all found money. That was a new revenue stream. And this is kind of my whole point. The way we think about information, it's kind of not as complex as it actually needs to be, because physical objects and things that we consume as electronic objects, they're very different. We consume them in different ways. They have different price points and different audiences.
Yeah. Nina Paley is a cartoonist and filmmaker, and she is a native of Urbana, Illinois, where I'm sitting now. And you can download her movie, Sita Sings the Blues, online. You can download it for free. You can also buy it. She calls herself a free culture activist, not a pirate.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's very interesting. And she actually has written a song about her philosophy. And I thought we'd play it here.
Wonderful.
All right, here we go.
Okay, here we go. Dun-dun-dun-dun, copying isn't theft. Stealing a thing leaves one less left. Copying it makes one thing more. That's what copying's for. Copying isn't theft. If I copy yours, you have it too. One for me and one for you. That's what copies can do. If I steal your bicycle, you have to take the bus. But if I just copy it, there's one for each of us. Making more of a thing. That is what we call copying. Sharing ideas with everyone. That's why copying is fun.
And there you have it. What do you think of the song?
Yeah, that's a great song, and it's a very good point. I mean, it's a really, really tough thing for us to understand as in both individuals and as a society, because as the song says, copying is not theft. But there's definitely questions about, well, okay, what, you know, should copyright law continue as it has, or mm-hmm. should it change? There are definitely pros to people being able to copy all kinds of things, but there are also cons, and there are two sides to this argument. We do need to adapt and learn to kind of reorganize ourselves around this new reality we face, that we can copy all kinds of stuff, and that's not gonna lessen in any way. I mean, if you look at all these emerging technologies like rapid prototyping and 3D printing, we're just figuring out new and even crazier ways to copy stuff. It's possible, or it's soon going to be possible for people to copy physical objects the way that they copy electronic objects. And that sounds a little far-fetched, but it's already happening with technology such as 3D printing, which is the 3D printers, these machines about the size of photocopiers that print out prototypes of physical objects, usually made from starches or ceramics or resins. They're used in the design space for designers to sort of look at prototypes they've designed. But if you talk to people in that industry, they think that in 5 to 10 years' time, we'll actually be printing out physical objects made of more than one material. Well, what does Nike do when kids can download sneakers the way they download MP3 players? I mean, mm-hmm. it becomes a totally different argument, and it is something that we, I think, need to take very seriously as a society. We need to look at the benefits and the costs, and that's kind of the point I really try and argue in the Pirate's Dilemma. It's not all doom and gloom, but it's not all this kind of digital utopia either. It's an entirely new set of uncharted waters that we need to learn to navigate as a society.
Yeah, and we might get a little seasick along the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us about Adrian Bowyer.
So Adrian Bowyer is a really, really fascinating guy working on a really amazing project called the RepRap, which is a 3D printer. He's a professor at the University of Bath in England, and he's designed a 3D printer called the RepRap, which can actually print out a copy of itself. It can print out a 3D printer, you have to assemble it, prints out all the parts, you don't have to assemble it. But the first 3D printer that could print a copy of itself went online last May. Didn't really get a lot of press or any attention, but I mean, that's pretty big news. The first self-replicating machine replicated itself. That's pretty huge. Once that technology matures, the idea of an economic system based on scarcity, I guess, doesn't go away in some respects. We still have got one planet, and we've still got a finite amount of resources. But if anybody can copy anything, and, I mean, suddenly a bunch of different industries change. We're seeing that happen with any information that's digital. We're seeing that happen to movies and music and newspapers and any other content that can be shared over the internet. It's facing some really tough questions at the moment, but these questions are coming to everybody else as well. And this is really kind of what I wanted to do in the book, is not kind of sort of put forth one argument over another, but just say, look, this is how these situations played out in other areas, or this is when other people are faced with really disruptive ideas about how their little microcosm of society works, this is what that did. And kind of, you know, try and draw on the past to look at how we might navigate all this.
Yeah. You say the roots of the Pirate's Dilemma are in punk capitalism, and you liken punk to a Category 5 hurricane. How and why did punk so seriously shake things up?
Well, it was really interesting, because if you actually look at the kind of initial burst of activity that was kind of considered the first wave of punk, it didn't really last very long, and it was kind of quite contained. It was a couple of clubs, a couple of bands, a few hit records, and some sort of a national kind of media storm in the UK and here in the States. But then it sort of disappeared from view, but it was kept alive by hardcore bands and all the things that followed, all the things that grew out of punk. what was so interesting about punk, it had this sort of, this really DIY attitude that you could do or make anything yourself, from fanzines to fashion labels to record labels. So much was done by bands and fans themselves. But there's these two sort of, this seemingly opposing forces at work in punk, the voice sort of kept it moving. One is this idea that you could combine self-interest with altruism. So you can further your cause, whether that be anarchy or getting a record deal. But you also have to consider your fans, and you have to consider everybody else, and this very sort of altruistic bent that punk has, which is not really well understood or often talked about, but punk is all about putting purpose before profit. And the reason I likened where capitalism's going now to punk in the book is because we're really seeing that happen as corporations and society becomes ever more transparent. The amounts of accountability and the things that companies can do without being heavily scrutinized, I mean, it's totally changing. If you look at, even this week, if you look at the way Goldman Sachs is being picked over versus the way it was talked about after what it did in the 1929, in the Depression, in the 30s, it's a totally different conversation. It's happening in a totally different way. And that company, one of the most powerful companies in the world, is having to respond in a way they're not used to. So all kinds of companies, from the hugest to the smallest, are facing new levels of scrutiny, and doing the right thing is becoming much more important than your advertising budget and what you say you do and what you pretend to do. You have to do the right thing, or you will be called out on it. So this idea that we're living in an era where companies really have to combine their own self-interest with the kind of the interests of society, it's kind of taking on more importance.
You know, to what extent have the technological tools we have today, the internet, social networks, to what extent have they allowed for the magnification of do-it-yourself DIY?
I mean, it's been pretty profound, and we're kind of seeing the first wave of this. If you think about the Industrial Revolution, people talk about that. We think of it now as something that happened in a very short space of time. It took 100 years for the Industrial Revolution to happen. And I think we're in the first decade of a similar revolution, a similarly massive upheaval. And we've already seen great change. The idea that publishing, once something that was very scarce, and you had to have a printing press and a distribution system and an office full of professional journalists, and that's the way that you did publishing, that idea has completely evaporated, and so is the way that you advertise to fund that business. The same thing in the music industry. The tools of production have fallen into the hands of people anywhere and everywhere, and so the music business is taking on a very different shape, while the business of making music, which is something entirely different, is also changing. There are many more albums available today than at any time before in history. But the music industry is shrinking. So we're seeing a lot of crazy stuff happening. A lot of industries are shrinking, getting smaller, and the money seems to be moving. And in some cases, the money seems to be evaporating altogether. People have always done stuff like making music and written things for fun or just for pure enjoyment. And now all of those people can make their stuff just as accessible as the people who do it to make a living. And it's going to mean that some of the people who do it to make a living are going to get squeezed. And it also means that's the bad news. The good news is that there are all these new revenue streams that are starting to take shape. If you look at even some of the largest, most commercial artists in the world, they're now finding all these other ways to make money because more people are listening to their music. So, like Justin Timberlake, for example, signed to Sony BMG, currently has over 150 revenue streams. One of those revenue streams is selling recorded music. So times are really changing, and the money is moving, and it's moving into new areas. And the people who do well in this new environment are the people who work out how they can monetize that attention that they're getting from places that we previously didn't used to capitalize on.
Yeah, it seems to me that there is a huge need for a lot of creativity here, a lot of really smart, clever people.
Right.
Maybe you would talk, give us another example, a personal one from your life story. In 2001, you and some folks launched a music magazine, which was a really tall order in the year 2001.
Yeah.
And you had to be really clever about it. What did you do?
Well, I mean, we looked at this was in London, in England, where I grew up. And we launched this music magazine around the idea of we wanted to create a magazine that represented the music that was being played on all pirate radio stations in the UK. And I grew up in London. I was a pirate radio DJ for many years. And I worked in the media business for a large magazine company. And so I was passionate about this idea of creating a brand, creating a media platform that truly represented what was going on in London, because there was nothing out there that really did that. But we knew that we weren't going to get the shelf space in the big news agents, in the Hudson News and so forth. We knew that that wasn't an option for us, and we knew, more importantly, that's not where our audience were. But we also knew that the market that we were talking to and representing was a really lucrative market. You're talking about 15 to 24s with a lot of disposable income that advertisers find it really, really difficult to get to because they could never say credible things to them. So instead of charging our audience for the magazine, we gave the magazine away for free, and we only put it in the coolest record shops in London, the coolest clothing stores, and just the coolest places outside the coolest clubs. And every copy was gone within 72 hours. We'd print 30,000 copies and just give this thing away everywhere we could. And it very quickly became a very, very important piece of the London club scene. And it's since grown into one of the UK's largest youth brands. And it happened that way because we kind of put the audience first. We realized that they were kind of the center of this conversation. And our job as a magazine was to kind of facilitate that conversation and get advertisers on board in a way that didn't really make sense in other magazines. Like we didn't need to be around the magazine distribution system as it existed for everybody else. That just wasn't going to work for us. Charging for our content was not an option, but we knew that there was attention. We could get people's attention, and once we had that, we could charge money for advertisements, and the amount we used to charge for a page in Rewind was much, much higher than all of our closest competitors, and we got way more from them because it actually worked. Because we took the money out of these other two parts of the model where magazines traditionally made money, we got much more attention, and we were able to capitalize on that. And this is really the trick. When the attention moves, when disruptive technology means things start going a different way and attention starts flowing in a different direction, you have to change your business model. You have to go where the money is. You have to find a different way to capitalize on that attention. And that's kind of what we managed to do.
So what are the lessons here for the news media today?
I mean, I think the big lesson for the news media is working out how to capitalize on the attention that you get. And there's not the thing is for the news media, there really isn't one answer. There's a different answer for every single publication. It really depends on your audience. So if you're a financial news service, you can probably continue to charge your audience for financial news because people in the finance industry want really up to the minute news, and it's worth a lot more than to them than news that's a day old or even an hour old. They can capitalize on that. They'll make money on that. So they'll pay you if you can give them that news as it happens. The New York Times has a different business model. People who read the New York Times don't need that stuff as it happens. They detailed analysis the next day. The New York Times is experimenting with paywalls and stuff again. I don't know how well that's going to work. But it can be done. The journal's doing it. I think the really uncomfortable truth in all of this is that a lot of newspapers are just going to go away because that whole function in society is being performed by people who are not being paid and has been doing so for some time. You have incredible media networks made entirely of volunteers. The one that comes to mind for me, a shining example, is a network of blogs called globalvoices.org, which is run by a really smart guy called Ethan Zuckerman. He's got a network of bloggers all over the world. This is one of the best sources for news coming out of places like Iran, Burma, any type of unrest that's happened around the world. Global Voices has been there first, and nobody's getting paid there. So that business model's really in trouble, because if somebody else is doing what you did for free, mm-hmm. and they're doing it better than you are, then why should you be able to charge money for luxury handbag ads on the front page of the piece of paper that you print your news on? I mean, it's just not as efficient anymore. So there is going to be a lot of creative destruction, as Schumpeter and Schumacher have kind of talked about it. There are going to be a lot of big companies that are not doing what they used to do. So, and I mean, there's no kind of getting around that. We are in a period of upheaval. But the good news is that whenever this has happened, if you look at the history of the media industry, whether it's been pirates attacking business models, whether it's been some kind of disruptive technology, the business always grows as a result. The old business model is destroyed, and that happens very quickly, and that's what's happening right now. But to paraphrase Clay Shirky, it's easy to break things, it's harder to fix them, it takes longer. And that's what we're going to see next. We're going to go through this long, probably quite arduous process where some companies fall by the wayside, but other ones figure out a completely new way to do what it is they do, to add value to their audiences. Mm. And to make more money. And I mean, if you look at the history of the media industry, this is how it's always happened. I mean, I'm optimistic. I think we're going to find a better way to do all of the stuff doing at the moment.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Matt Mason. He is an entrepreneur. He's a writer. He is the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. One of the pioneers of punk was a fellow by the name of Richard Myers, better known as Richard Hell. And when you talked with him recently, you quoted him as saying, "The interesting thing is not to remain the same." And then he said also, "The point is to stay unclassifiable." What does he mean?
Right. What does he mean?
Yeah.
Well, I guess, I mean, when you're talking about youth cultures like punk, it's kind of, there are two things going on. You've got people at the edge, like Richard Hell, who are trying to break what society does or experiment or take things in a new direction. And then when he was around, and even more so now, you've got these piranha-like teams of marketers and advertisers and cool hunters and youth culture corporate gurus who are trying to figure out how they can monetize all this new culture that's being created. I mean, this is how capitalism works. We take culture and we take products and we attach meaning to them by conveying kind of cultural attachments to them. So you want to sell fizzy drinks to 15-year-olds, you find out what those 15-year-olds are listening to, and you put that music in the background of your advert, and they'll buy more fizzy drinks. It's just kind of how it's always worked. So the point he was making about staying unclassifiable was he didn't want punk to be owned in this way. He didn't want punk to become monetized and commercialized, which, of course, in one sense it was, and in another sense it wasn't. And I think that's what's really so interesting about what's kind of happening with youth culture now, because the thing that all of the record labels missed, and these are the people, some of the smartest people in the world, the people who are able to monetize punk and disco and hip-hop and all of these very, very radical forms of youth culture, at least when they started, they were able to turn them into these kind of bloated corporate carcasses of their former selves
mm-hmm.
and sell them to millions and millions of people. And what all of the record labels missed about piracy and file sharing and Napster and all of this stuff that happened 10 years ago, what they all failed to see was this was a youth movement. This was something founded on a very different ideal. And if they'd tried to monetize it the way they monetized disco, we'd probably all be laughing about it now. But because they didn't do that, because they saw this as a technological problem, it ate them alive.
It seems to me that the up-and-coming generation has always been the source of new ideas and new ways of doing things. Why don't the corporate stalkers pay attention?
They do pay attention. I think the problem with things now, with the way the internet and the way kind of new ideals that the internet has instilled in a young generation, I mean, this is something so disruptive that it's just been impossible for a lot of people to see this as a form of youth culture they could monetize, because it's literally also completely decimating their business model at the same time. Punk didn't do that. The Sex Pistols didn't do that at EMI Records. They weren't decimating their business model. They were just singing Smash the System. The Pirate Bay is literally smashing EMI Records system. So it is very different. And the Pirate Bay has just been monetized. And so I think we're going to see, we are seeing people are starting to kind of get this now. That is something that kind of needs to happen. And I mean, this is definitely my point of view, is that as tragic as it is that youth cultures are kind of, they go mainstream and they get monetized.
Mm-hmm.
It's also inevitable. It's something that kind of needs to happen, because if it doesn't, then culture stagnates, and that's not cool either. For cultures to be kind of monetized and turned into the mainstream thing is what creates new space and new things to happen. And this is kind of something I really sort of was aware of growing up in London, being a pirate radio DJ, is that the turnover of music scenes on pirate radio, a music scene won't last more than 3 or 4 years. There'll be a scene like grime or drum and bass, or the new sort of funky house scene that's happening right now in London. These scenes last 3 or 4 years. There's a couple of hit records. There's maybe one album or one big artist that then crosses over, and then it's done, and something else happens. They get monetized quickly, and that's it. They're over, and then something else happens. That's cool, because it keeps DJs and it keeps people innovating, and it keeps us coming up with new ideas. So I don't see this as a bad thing. Like, when people talk about bands selling out and, you know, movements being kind of cannibalized by corporations, well, I mean, it's kind of human nature. It's what we do. It's how we clear out the old to make way for new stuff. So the fact that culture has now found a way to cannibalize the commercial world to make way for new commercial business models, to me, that seems just as inevitable and just as healthy and productive.
Mm.
I think what's going on right now it's going to be a really good thing in the end. Probably take us another decade to kind of get through it, but in the end, we'll be better off.
Mm. The interesting thing is not to remain the same.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. You say we'd be wise to recognize the pirate within ourselves. How do we do that, and why is that the thing to do?
So my argument about recognizing the pirate within yourself is really based on the fact that we are now all capable of being pirates, whether we want or not. We can take anybody else's intellectual property or information, and we can copy it, and we can remix it, and we can do whatever, we can rebroadcast it. And anybody can do the same with our intellectual property or our idea or information. So we're kind of all in the same boat, so to speak. And the interesting thing about piracy is, while it's often a really bad thing, and it often is theft, and it often is funding drugs or terrorism or all this really bad stuff, like counterfeiting is a very, very serious business. It's a very easy way to make money if you're a criminal and you're trying to fund other nefarious activities. I mean, there's always somewhere in that equation, there is some value that the mainstream can take advantage of. There are places for us to capitalize on what pirates are doing. You can always beat pirates by copying with them. And so my whole argument about finding the pirate within yourself is really about finding the value that pirates are adding to what you do. If something that you make or produce is being heavily pirated or copied in an entirely different way to the way you do it, well, maybe that's a market signal that that's something you could be doing. So if you look at the way Steve Jobs looked at Napster, when all the record labels were looking at it as a criminal enterprise, his attitude was, well, the way to stop this is to compete with it.
Mm.
And that's what Apple did when they came up with iTunes. If you look at the way iTunes works and functions, it's kind of a lot like a file sharing site. It looks very similar in terms of design and the way you navigate it to a lot of the early file sharing sites. He beat the pirates by copying them, and Apple Computers was able to become a major player in the music industry, which people would have laughed at you if you'd said that just a couple of years before. And I think this is something that we can do. This is something I've been able to do as an individual with the book by releasing the e-version of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is something we can do whether you're a single author or a large corporation. There's value for all of us in what pirates are doing. We may not agree with it. It may be illegal. It may be morally wrong and bankrupt. Doesn't mean there's not value in it for you. And it's often a really smart thing to look if you can see that value and you can do it in the kind of legitimate world, well, you're going to find money that you didn't have before.
Yeah. You've used the word a couple of times, I believe, in our conversation so far, altruism. And going back to Nina Paley and her philosophy about copying, she says that she's found that people want to reward artists, not steal from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look back through the history of human civilization, we've always rewarded creative people since before we even had money. This is something we've done, and I don't think that's going to go away. Yeah, it's easy to steal stuff now, but it doesn't mean that people don't want to give you money. I get emails every day from people write me long emails explaining why they didn't pay for the electronic copy of the book. They just lost their job, they're a student, whatever it is. A lot of people feel if they do take it for free, they feel compelled to tell me why. And I don't care. I'd rather not the emails. I'm happy for them to just have a free copy of the book. But people feel like, okay, well, I should have rewarded this person, I didn't. And that, to me, was something I didn't see coming. But it makes sense because we do want to reward creative people, and we will continue to do that. The trick is if you're in an industry where it's very, very easy for people to take your stuff for free, you've just got to give people more options to pay for it, more ways to experience it. I think we're seeing this in the media industries. If you look at film and TV, they're experimenting with this thing that people call transmedia. Henry Jenkins at UCLA, this term he came up with, which kind of describes sort of a deeper experience that we're having with storytelling, where sometimes there'll be a TV show like Heroes is a good example. You have the show on TV and NBC sells advertising around that, but then there's characters and story arcs that don't make it into the main show that are left on the cutting room floor, and they're now put out as a comic book, or they turn up as webisodes somewhere else. So if you're a really, really big Heroes fan, there's more stuff there for you to experience. You can get deeper into the story and the characters and the whole franchise. And NBC makes over $50 million a season on Heroes in advertising revenue, not including TV advertising revenue. So that's all found money for them. That's new money from just extending the storylines further in ways that storytellers have always done. Writers always develop characters and story arcs that don't make it into the story. Well, the great thing about the internet is there's now all these places you can leave those story arcs. You can put them up for people to find, and you can sell ads around them, or you can sell physical copies of them. And true fans will buy them. If you're making good stuff, you're going to make money. That hasn't changed.
Hmm. Matt Mason is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a writer and an entrepreneur. He's the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm appreciating the show. I'm thinking Project Gutenberg was developed locally even before there was a World Wide Web. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you've been to the website. This is an area where they give away public domain books just for completely free. So I'm wondering if you've been there, and if so, what kind of recommendations you would have that would feather along with your own insights.
I haven't been there, no, but that sounds really, really, really cool. And that's exactly the type of thing that I'm kind of talking about. I mean, what's really great about the public domain is it's always been this repository of culture and of art and of ideas that anybody can draw from. And what's so great about the web and the philosophy behind the web is that now it means more people can capitalize on that and enjoy that, and we can experience stuff like that in new ways. And I mean, this is really good when you're talking about public domain stuff.
Yeah,
that's awesome. I'm totally into that. It sounds great. I thought you were talking about Steve Guttenberg when you first said that.
Pardon me.
Steve Guttenberg from the Police Academy movies. That was my first association with the word,
yes,
Guttenberg, which is,
yes,
which shows about my horrible education. But there you go.
Well, this is a fellow in round town, lives in Urbana, and he, in 71, I don't know, I think he put across the Declaration of Independence. And from there, he's gone on. And it's kind of been overshadowed by Google, but this is something that you can download, really, just this whole vast volume, millions of books, for free. And you should check it out.
Yeah, no, I absolutely will. Thank you. Thanks for the recommendation.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, where is copyright headed, do you think?
I think copyright is headed somewhere else. I think it's something we still need, but I mean, most of the copyright laws that we have were written in the 18th and 19th centuries, and they suited business models of the 20th century fairly well, but none of those things are true anymore. We need copyright to change. I think the work of people like Professor Lawrence Lessig is the most progressive and most important stuff happening with copyright at the moment. Things like the Creative Commons movement. I mean, and what that essentially does is it unbundles copyright, because copyright isn't one right you have. It's actually a bunch of different things. And what Creative Commons allows you to do is to give people different permissions and different options and different ways to consume and use your work. So you can share something and let other people remix it, or you can choose for them not to remix it, in a number of different ways. And that's really cool. That's something that we really need, and we really need that to be part of actual copyright law. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, in terms of intellectual property law, the patent system as well, I think, is in for a huge shake-up. I think we're going to see a lot of new innovations there. People like Joseph Stiglitz have written some really, really convincing stuff on this and how problems with the patent system, especially when it comes to things like pharmaceuticals, which mean that millions of people can't get access to life-saving drugs, we're going to see some changes there too. And these things are good for all of us. It's going to take a little while for everybody to be convinced of that, but we're getting there, I think, slowly.
Yeah. You know, we need laws, and laws are boundaries. But one of the points you make in the book is that weaker boundaries equal stronger foundations. You want to talk with us about that idea for a moment?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that in terms of some of the boundaries that are being put in place, you're seeing two things happen with this whole debate around intellectual property, which often happens when you have two kind of very extreme groups distorting a debate. On one side, you've got a lot of companies and organizations like the Recording Industry Association of America or the Motion Picture Association of America who are actually kind of quite tough about this kind of zero tolerance thing about copying and about file sharing. And then on the other side, you've got the opposite kind of extremists. You've got not the Pirate Bay founders themselves, actually, but a lot of people kind of who are a part of the whole file sharing movement, who think that copyright, their sort of attitude is that just smash the system. None of these big Hollywood stars or musicians deserve any money at all. Nobody deserves any money. Just break it all, which is, and they're both very simple, reductionist, and actually quite ignorant points of view. And the most people sort of fall somewhere in the middle of those two extremes. And what I think we need to see is culture reflect that, because it really doesn't at the moment. You hear from both of these two groups of extremists a lot, but what you don't hear from is most people in the middle. If you go and talk to most people at a record label, they kind of think file sharing is okay and maybe we should have monetized it 10 years ago. And yeah, okay, well, you know, it's bad, but, you know, this is how it is. And actually, we are finding new ways to make money. I mean, most people aren't in these two camps. Most people are somewhere in the middle. And I think we need to get back to talking in slightly less kind of alarmist tones about this stuff. Because, yeah, it's a problem, but it's mostly a solution. It's mostly a good thing. I think if we're measured about it and we actually look at the evidence and we actually look at the potential of new business models versus the sort of imagined new threats, we're actually going to find better ways to do things. We're actually going to find better ways for artists to earn money and for the industries that exist around them to flourish and grow. Mm.
And is doing that work, is that the essentially the pirate's dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I spend my time doing now, is working with different organizations and people, trying to help them sort of find this middle ground and trying to find a way to make sense of this kind of new system. And it's really interesting because the subtitle of the book is How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I've been charged that that's grandiose and misleading, but I actually think that when you really get down to it, that's what's happening. We're getting back to a more kind of classical definition of economics that was imagined by people like Adam Smith. We're getting back to a type of economics where if you're not really adding value to the society that you're in, to the planet that you live on, then there's just no point in you being in the marketplace. So if you're doing any kind of rent-seeking activity that doesn't add any value, there's no place for you. And that's really interesting, actually. That's kind of a major shift, because we've kind of been operating in this kind of neoclassical world, which came apart at the seams at the end of last year and is still coming apart at the seams. Mm-hmm. And we're getting somewhere else where if you're not doing something that's useful, you're not going to be able to do it for too long anymore. The world's way too transparent now. And this whole shift, this whole digital shift, piracy, is just kind of one symptom of this much, much larger revolution that's happening.
Yeah, I think it will be very interesting to see what is ahead in terms of consumer activism and political activism, because things are really changing quickly on those fronts as well. We have to wrap up here, and in thinking about consumer activism, I thought I would play what has come to be known as the complaint anthem. This is United Throws Guitars. It is a viral video, and it's really made a name for this band, the Sons of Maxwell. You want to just make a quick comment, Matt, and then we'll play it and we'll wrap things up here.
Yeah, absolutely. No, this is one of my favorite videos the last few weeks. A band got their guitar broken on a United flight. United wasn't going to do anything about it. They threatened to write a song called United Throws Guitars. They did. Millions of people watched it on YouTube. Suddenly United wants to buy them new guitars, which is awesome. I mean, that's amazing. That now, instead of just writing a complaint letter that was ignored, you can suddenly galvanize the support of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, and United will end up buying you a new guitar. I do worry that in future, the only people who will be able to complain are the people who can write the best songs. that's a worry. But, you know, on balance, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. I think if all this stuff happening now, I think in hundreds of years' time, we're going to have statues to the founders of the way that we communicate on the internet, the coders and the programmers, people like Richard Stallman, Richard Feynman, all of these intellectual giants who came up with this new way of communicating, because it's just changing things every day. in ways that were unimaginable. And United Throwing Guitars is just the latest piece of that puzzle. Mm.
Matt Mason is the author of The Pirate's Dilemma, How Youth Culture is Reinventing Capitalism. Look for him online at thepiratesdilemma.com. Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Celeste.
United Airlines on my way to Nebraska. The plane departed Halifax, connecting in Chicago's O'Hare. While on the ground, a passenger said from the seat behind me, "My God, they're throwing guitars out there." The band and I exchanged a look, best described as terror, at the action on the tarmac, and knowing whose projectiles these would be. So before I left Chicago, I alerted three employees who showed complete indifference towards me. United.